Ladies, gents, boys and girls, yep, you're right. You're on to the 90 Minutes Plus podcast. The last time she was here, I used to call it the first X Minutes podcast, but that was in 2020. And now 4 years, well, 3 years and some months down the line, she's back again with us. And we've been chatting about so many things, and we thought, hey, let's start the podcast proper and let us get into the meat of things. I'm Ruti Midaramola, and you'll find more podcast content on Twitter, the 90 Minutes Plus, THE90MINSPLUS. She introduced herself the last time she was here, but I want her to introduce herself again, because truth of the matter is that a lot has happened between the last time she was here and today that we're having this chat. Hi, Debola. Welcome to the chat. For the sake of those who missed, I need to go and check that episode so that I can make references to it. I think it's episode 97 of the podcast. I'll make sure to be sure that that number is correct. Debola, please, for the sake of those who missed the initial episode recorded in 2020, kindly reintroduce yourself. Welcome to the chat.
Thank you for having me. I cannot remember what I introduced myself as in 2020, to be honest. I'm sure I must have said something like I was a journalist at the BBC. I can't imagine that I must have said anything else. But hey, I am an ex-journalist for the BBC. But right now, I work as a campaigns and internal communications manager at FIFPro at the Global Union for Football Players Worldwide. And yeah, it's great to be here. It's great we're having this chat like 3 years after COVID happened, which is, I think, a tremendous shift for anybody. But then it's not just COVID that has happened in my life. A lot has happened with, you know, moving to Europe, doing a master's degree in sports management, starting a new life, pretty much, working at the top level in football, as I dreamed, and just, you know, adjusting to everything all over again. So, yeah, it's not just COVID that was a monumental shift for me in my life since 2020. And yeah, all of that has been like tough. It's like I'm learning something new every day. It's like I'm not exactly prepared for the next thing that is going to happen with each day. But overall, it's been like very, very rewarding.
Just for the record, and so that I got it right, can you tell me, I'm not getting to FIFPro yet. We need to start from the very beginning. But just your role, can you describe that job role again, or description of the title? Campaigns and...
I don't know why you picked up that. It's a very interesting title. Campaigns and internal communications managers.
Ladies and gentlemen, Debola Adepanjov. Let's start from where we picked up. By the way, I said I will confirm the last episode. I'm right. Episode 97, recorded or published on the 15th of June 2020. You should check it out. 5 key lessons from the journey to the BBC and an unfair goat debate. That's a funny title we gave it, but hey, that was myself and Debola chatting about work and also about her love for Arsenal, which I see is still very, very much alive. Very much alive. I think you were at the Emirates watching your boys conquer the Portuguese visitors. We'll talk about that probably later. Let's talk about the BBC, Debola. The last time you were here, you were at BBC, and we shared lessons from joining and working at BBC. You've left. What was leaving the BBC like? Why did you leave? I think that's a two-in-one question. If we can take that from you, why did you leave? I mean, it's the BBC, right? Why did you leave, and what did it feel like leaving the organization?
Yeah, it was my big break. So yeah, it's the BBC indeed. And it was a bittersweet moment for me to leave, if I can use that word, because I thoroughly loved working at the Beep. I was in a role where I had freedom to be as creative as much as I wanted. I was working with a lot of athletes. I was working really closely with athletes, understanding, you know, the different things that we never used to see from the outside. I also got a promotion About 3 to 6 months before I left to be the digital lead for the Sport Africa team. So it was pretty exciting. Like, I had no reason to leave. I had brilliant colleagues as well, whom, you know, like I was telling you before we started this podcast, were very supportive. They were great with feedback. They were easy to work with. They were always like, you know, championing ideas and championing me as a person. And that's, I think that's something you get for a lot of people, or a lot of young people who work at the BBC will tell you, the experience as well, or particularly in the team I worked with. So it was a very great place to work. You know, I was learning hands-on and everything. However, when you have like a dream, or you're, you know, generally just ambitious and you like to explore things you've promised yourself that you always wanted to do, you just find yourself gravitating towards things like that. And the FIFA Master was one of those things for me. So I like travel. I liked the idea of going abroad to do a master's program that will, you know, that is set across 3 different countries. There is a particular picture I saw. Someone showed me, I think it was Samson Adamu, who is the competitions manager at CAF. I think he was in one of the editions of the FIFA Master, I think 2009, which was 13 years before I joined mine. And I think they did a school visit or a field trip to, was it FIFA or was it a football club or something? And it was just nice to see, you know, that image of, you know, young people being able to go to all these football clubs and all these footballers and organizations that, you know, we've always like, you know, talked about and dreamed about back home, you know, in Nigeria. So it was kind of like, hey, this would be nice to do this as well. But I remember when I checked, when I first came across the FIFA Master in 2016, I saw the fee. It was like 25,000 Swiss francs. It still is 25,000 Swiss francs. And I was like, yeah, no way I'm going to be able to afford this.
Wow.
But then I also saw that I had a scholarship. And then I told myself back in 2016 that, yeah, if I was ever going to go, I'm going to, you know, get the scholarship, and I will get that scholarship. So it was just something I had at the back of my mind that one day I'm just going to try it. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, you know, it doesn't. I remember that in 2019, I was supposed to apply. That was before, the year before COVID, I was supposed to apply to that program because it usually closes at the start of the year in January. But then I went to like Dirty December in Ghana, and I was just like, yeah, I'm never going to make the application. So, you know, when you start a new year and you're feeling very motivated to just, you know, get things going, I just thought, yeah, like you've always said you wanted to try apply for this stuff. So how about you do it this year? And that was really how I did it, because like I said, I just got in a promotion at the BBC that I loved working at. I also registered my podcast production company sometime between December and January 2021. Nice. So I had plans to actually be in the country and, you know, create the things I want to create and get my future and career going in the aspect that I wanted it to go. But because, you know, those things I was doing, you know, as well in Nigeria were things that I had on my bucket list, just like applying for the program was. So I just thought, okay, I'm just going to give it a shot, and whether it happens, you know, it happens. And if it doesn't, that's fine. I tried. And then I remember applying, I think 5 minutes before the deadline. That was when I was able to send all of my stuff in. I like leaving things dead like that. It's the adrenaline it gives me. Anyway, I submitted and I just, you know, moved on from the submission. But then I started getting, you know, call back for the first stage. Then there was a second stage interview. Then there was a third stage interview. And I was faced with the question of, you know, will I take the program? Like, okay, we're going to give you a partial scholarship. And for anybody listening, I can get into the details of how that works later. But, you know, I was faced with the decision of, you know, whether to accept the admission or continue, you know, the job at the BBC. I didn't quite have the money, to be fair, but I just thought, okay, how many times in the world do people get an opportunity like this, you know? I did not exactly have like a big grand plan for after the master's as well. It was just like going with what was in front of me. You know, I have gotten an admission for the most prestigious sports management masters in Europe. It's been like number one for, I think, 9 years running. Are you going to take it, or are you just going to, I don't know. I didn't actually think of not taking it, to be fair, because yeah, it was a very big risk, but it just made sense that I throw myself at it and see what happens. And that was what I did, to be honest. So, and at the time I took it, I told my manager at the BBC, and everyone was, you know, very happy for me as well. I had, I think from admission to when I left, I had about, I knew I was going in March 2021 and I left in August. So my math is terrible. I think that was about 6 months or 5 months. So I had time to, you know, still continue my work at the BBC and do a lot of the, and continue the new role that I was in. And in that time as well, I got a lot of the support I needed. It was a very tough month because I was looking for, you know, how to finance myself for the coming months and how to get prepared to leave and still also doing my job and doing it well. Yeah, but it was a pretty rewarding month too, I would say. And yeah, everyone was happy for me to go do the masters. And what was also interesting is I did not resign at that point at the BBC. I just said I was going to take a career break. So I was happy to come back, you know, come back to my role. And people were like, yeah, your role is going to be here for you by the time you're back, if, you know, that's what, you know, is going to happen. And yeah, I just went on an adventure, I would say, because yeah, it was pretty much like an adventure more than me going to do a master's in sports management. But then by the time I got there, it was like me getting as familiar as it was, because I mean, it was sports. We're talking about the athletes that we've worked with. We're talking about the industry. As familiar as it was, as it all was, there was still that element of facing something very real and understanding the layers to just the football match or the 90 minutes football match I had been watching. So it quickly turned from an adventure to serious business, if that made sense. And yeah, it's been, I keep saying rewarding, but yeah, it's been a very interesting and rewarding journey so far. I think I might have skipped, answered a lot of the questions you've asked, but that's the long and short, pretty much. More like the long than the short. That's the long of leaving the BBC and how that happened.
I know that because for those who are listening, and whenever the weather comes around, I always make sure, I know it's the second time, but I always make sure there's a notepad and there's a pen for you to jot things down, especially. And I think we have three segments. I think we've divided this into three, if not four. We might squeeze Arsenal into the fourth part, because wherever it's developed, definitely Arsenal has to be somewhere in there. So we're talking about Hart leaving the BBC, transitioning into the FIFA Masters program. And from that, we are going to take it to another level and talk about the FIFA Pro. But just before we take things away from the BBC, you mentioned something earlier, and I think I just want to touch on that a little bit. You said it was told to you that your role is going to be here waiting for you. And, you know, it just gives that mentality of your kind of person and the work ethic, or the, should I say, the strength, the energy you put into your work, so much so that you were leaving. And maybe you wanted to go for a break initially, and they were like, look, whenever you go, come back, you are good enough to not give this job to anybody else. You are the one that's going to fill it in. And I think what I learned from that is the fact that hard work pays off when you put in your all, when you show exceptionalism. It only speaks for itself in the long run. And you get people who will either recommend you, who would either speak for you, who would either appreciate your work, although some people may not do the appreciation loudly, but internally they're saying, look, Debola is good at this thing. So I think I picked that from the last response that you gave. And yes, I think you answered even some of the questions that I've read, I've not even asked, you answered. And that's good. That works well for me. I think that people are tagging along. But before we leave BBC and go to FIFA Masters program, you mentioned it as being your big career break. That's working at BBC. And you also mentioned that it gave you the opportunity to get up close to athletes you've probably been looking at from afar, sports persons. Aside that, is there any other takeaway from your time working at the PIP? Aside from working with the sports stars, working with the sports personalities, what else was your takeaway from your time working at the BBC?
I think I learned how to make a mean-ass great video feature. And it's interesting as that just came to my head randomly, but I think storytelling is probably one of the biggest skill anyone can have in this age. It's ranked very highly. And I think I learned the hell out of that. I hope I'm able to swear. I learned a lot of that at the BBC. So my role, we produced a lot of features for TV, mainly. I know I did a lot of digital as well, and radio, and you know, live TV presenting from requests that we get across the BBC. But primarily, our role was to produce content, video content for a 30-minute weekly show that aired across Africa. So that was primarily what we needed to do every week. And you know what this process entails pretty much is, you know, filming a lot of footages, filming a lot of interviews, filming B-rolls for anyone who knows what B-rolls are. They're pretty much just, you know, sounds and films of things happening around you. That's what B-rolls are. And you have to merge all of this into a story, you know, plus the interview of the person you're speaking to as well. And by the time you go out to film and gather content, you could get at least 30 minutes worth of content. And I mean, when I say 30 minutes, that's been nice. Sometimes it's more than 30 minutes, and you have to piece all of that to create a 2 minutes, 30 seconds, you know, final visual product. And, that's a lot, you know, because there's a lot of messaging that is of course going to get lost. From all the B-rolls you did not use, but you have to make that 2 minutes, 30 seconds as concise, as succinct as possible to still pass the message and tell the story that you're trying to tell as good, you know, as it can get, you know. And I did that for 3 years, and with the help of people like, I almost said Piers Morgan. It's not Piers Morgan. No way Piers Morgan taught me shit. It's Piers Edwards. He was our senior producer at the BBC. my other colleague, Maury Barnell, Ben Sutherland, Martin Davies, my colleagues like Lynn Wachira and Michelle Katami in the Kenyan team as well. I think there was just a lot of learning from everybody that made, I dare say, me a master storyteller in that regard. It's something that now comes so naturally to me. It's a skill that is so useful in, you know, that I use all through my masters, that I use here at FIFA as well. I just know how to tell a visual story and tell it well. And, you know, yeah, the same skills can be applied to radio or anywhere really. So that is one skill I'm so glad I gained from the BBC. And I know it's so random and not a lot of people can relate with that. But yeah, it's literally one of the things I'm really good at. But more importantly, my takeaway from the BBC is something you referenced earlier when you talked about, you know, my colleagues saying that my job was waiting for me when I'm back, and the kind of qualities that must have led to that kind of, you know, reaction. I think working hard, working with integrity as well, being kind to people, you know, being nice to people, it definitely goes a long way in anyone's career. And I know people, there's an argument whether or not, you know, you need to be nice in your work environment. Now, I'm not saying you should not have boundaries. I'm not saying that they are not important, but there is just so much being liked can get you wherever it is you're working. And it comes in, you know, different ways as well. You know, you don't have to be fake about it. You don't have to do the things you don't want to do. But people respect some others that make them feel good. People respect others that just go about doing their work to the best of their abilities. People respect others who support them, because that's very important, as we feel so many things in the work environment. And I think that really is my biggest, you know, takeaway. Just show up, do the job you're supposed to do, be dependable, and watch how people, especially if they're good people, react to you. And that's very important. I would also say that there can be a very good reward in doing a little bit more than you're asked to, if that makes sense. And the reason I say that is my role at the BBC was a researcher role, even though, we had three other roles, a presenter role, and I think a multimedia journalist. It looks like such a long time, I cannot remember that. But I just didn't, you know, stick to that researcher boundary that I had. I ventured into so many other things. I showed them that I could produce. I showed them that I can present. And then it got to a stage, people started saying, hey, we've seen her do something like that. We think you'll be great for this opportunity and that opportunity. So it always helps if you have interests in your work environment, especially if it's a supportive work environment. It helps for you to go a little bit out of your line to demonstrate that you're capable of doing, you know, more than you've been assigned. So it just helps people see you differently as well, and subsequently they start, you know, seeing you in a way that promotes you in more ways than normal, if that makes sense. So yeah, those are my key takeaways. I still speak to a lot of my colleagues from the BEEB. I still get compliments and feedback that I've been one of the best people they've ever worked with, and it's not just, you know, coming my way. It's how I feel about
it. So sweet.
Yeah, it's also how I feel about some of these people. So yeah, it was pretty much a great time. Another takeaway I would say is employ young people in your work environment. And this is not for people who are working, this is for managers. Have young people in your work environment. One of the reasons I think I thrived in that environment was because a lot of my colleagues, people I worked with, you know, were young like me. We were curious, we had lots of energy, we wanted to do great work. And that's just the kind of environment you see people thrive a lot. So yeah, those are some of my takeaways from working at the BBC.
Wow. Anyway, I'm not surprised. It happened before and it's happening already. It's deja vu, ladies and gentlemen. Debola is here. And when Debola is here, you have a note. One page is full already. So, yeah, I just thought you should know. All right.
One page is full already? Oh, nice. That's flattering. Thank you.
Yeah, being nice and kind at your workplace. Storytelling is one of the biggest skills anyone can have. And then you became a master storyteller. And then you didn't just stick it to your researcher role. You went from there and you ventured into other roles. You followed the, you leveraged on your inquisitiveness, so to speak. And you ventured into other things that you felt could work for you. And that complemented your initial role, and then it's broadcasted your light even to more places than you working in your researcher role alone would have actually been able to broadcast. I don't know if that makes any sense, but in my head, I think it makes a lot of sense.
You're a great listener, which is probably the second greatest skill anyone should have. I don't think I think the biggest skill a communicator can have is listening, because it helps the conversation go like from good to great, I think. So no, that's superb. You didn't even miss a thing. That's amazing.
We do try our best. I try to listen at least once a year. I listen to our the other episode. It's one of the best. Because I find myself laughing at other times. I find myself listening to some things, and I was like, I've listened to this thing like 25 times. How did I miss this part that Debola was talking about? How you spoke about your journey. You've been a storyteller for a while now. You spoke about your journey from the NYC, how you met people that gave you the break in the radio station, and from that one thing led to another thing, another thing. And, you know, if you listen to it again, I don't think you have listened to it in a long time. You should. Not just because if you want to listen to it, but because you can even use it to now look at how far you have come from where you are coming from. And I think there will be a heart of gratitude somewhere in there. So, all right. I think we can as well name that first part of the conversation as things we are into storytelling waters. Now, we can as well say, I don't know the marketing term to use for that, but we can as well say young lady steps into the unknown. Not necessarily unknown. She knew where she was going, but I mean, she lives somewhere great in search for... she's following her travel. She wants to see what comes next for her, and she's especially following. You mentioned something. You said you've had the program in mind for a while now, and then you got the opportunity, and then you jumped at it. Let's switch to the FIFA Masters program. You mentioned a lot about it, and I think one thing I'm taking away from it is the fact that it's one of the highest ranked, if not the highest ranked, sports management course in Europe. But how is it that this thing is one of the highest ranked, but it is very, you could take 100 Nigerians, even 1,000 Nigerians, and maybe only 10 or 15 will probably know. I didn't know until recently about the FIFA Masters program. Okay, let's do a quick FIFA Masters program 101 crash course. Should we do that now? Talk us through how you got in. You said you got a partial scholarship, although we are not done with that part yet. Let's get a few details of how you got it before we talk about the one-on-one about the program. Does that work?
Yes, that works. Okay. So you want me to talk about how I got into the master's?
Exactly.
Okay. I feel like talking about that would also, in a way, lead into the one-on-one. Like, it's kind of like, you know, intertwined.
We're here for it. We are here for all of it.
Okay, cool. Where do I start? So I can pick up on why you are still surprised, or, you know, not still, but why you are surprised, and rightfully so, for how a lot of people, especially in Nigeria, do not know about the program. First, I think the financial implications, if I can use that word, of the master's is limiting, and that probably is the most valid reason. As at the time I applied, it was it 7 million naira? I cannot remember how much the rate was then. So it was like 25,000 Swiss francs. No, it was not 7 million naira. It was 14 million naira, and I had to pay 7 because I got a partial scholarship. So when you don't see a lot of people around you doing something, there is obviously no representation and visibility for the master. So it probably explains why, a lot of people just don't know that it exists. That is probably another lesson I think the FIFA Masters can take, or probably not take. They are like maxed out and booked every year with applications. So I guess they're doing okay and maybe don't exactly see reason to do a lot more on maybe their PR or comms. They're basically just focused on delivering a brilliant program for people, which they've been doing well and has kept them, you know, highly ranked. So yeah, I think that must be the reason, to be fair. Like I said, I heard about it because, and I'm going to mention his name. His name is Bolaji Aluku, who also has been trying to get into the program. We both worked at Hotspots then, and he just was trying to talk about Samson Adamu. You know, he was trying to say, oh wow, you know, Samson Adamu, he is so rich. I hope it's okay to say that. And he did this master's, which of course then explains as well, I'm just going to pick it up again, because I think there was a call that came in. Can you hear me?
That works. Yes, I'm still with
Okay, I'm gonna pick it up again. Yeah, and the fact that Samson was the last Nigerian at the Masters prior to me, and seeing his background of, you know, studying across the world prior to that, it shows that, you know, financial gap for such program, which, you know, lasts less than a year, even. It's about 11 months. But yeah, like I said, that's how I discovered it. And I'm happy that tons of people as well from seeing me as well discovered it, you know, after that. I think that's the natural progression to how these things work. In other countries like India, some parts of Asia as well, the program is very popular there because, you know, there've been representation, lots of representation from that part of the world. Yeah, and I'm just happy that, you know, Africa as well is getting, people are the program is being more visible to them because it does have very, very good potential to you know, create good leaders for the future of sports on the continent. So yeah, I hope that answers that part of the question. So what happened after I found out? Well, I applied 4 years after. The way it works is there is a form online that you need to fill. That's pretty much like the first exam. And there are two, I wish I prepared better for this, but I will just give a quick overview. There are two key questions that needs answering. I think one of the questions is, what would you change in the sports industry? Something like that. And then it asks you to give like an overview of why or how you think, or rather why you think you're a good fit to work or to work in an international environment in this context to school with, you know, lots of other people from different nationalities. I think those are the two key questions you need to properly demonstrate, because yeah, it's like every other master's application, I would imagine. You know, what is your motivation or your personal statement for applying and things like that. So you go through that whole process. You submit your transcripts and all of that stuff at once. You also need to answer some questions about your financial capability, which I would recommend that everyone be as honest and truthful as possible in there. You know, they asked you when I was applying, I didn't have shit. Well, I had my little savings, but it's not like I had like a car or I had, you know, diamonds in my account, because I think that was a bit they said, even if you have diamonds, tell us you have it. So yeah, they just ask those questions. And I think the reason they do that is so they know, you know, who is in need of, you know, funding or not, because quite a number of students do apply for scholarships, and it's not just African students, you know, European students also, people from North America, a lot of places as well need, you know, the scholarship, because it's a lot of money. And it's not just the fees, it's the fact that you're moving across different countries, paying rent in different countries, and that kind of stuff. So that's the application process. During my time, I know that over 700 people applied. It's different from, I guess, a regular master's in the sense that, you know, you get your admission first, or you just apply and there is no like extra screening processes. As with some schools, say in the UK or thereabouts. This one, after you submitted your form, there are like two other stages of interviews. You know, I think there was one stage with, I can't remember the number of people who interviewed me in the first stage, but I know there were at least 4 or 5 people. And then the second stage or the final stage interview, you have more people, and, you know, someone asks you questions, and then the scientific committee, that's the people that interview you, just wow. Listen to your response and gauge, you know, what you have to say. So they're asking you familiar questions. Why are you, you know, coming to the masters? They are very keen on gaining knowledge and taking it back to your country of origin to actually develop and change things there as much as possible. And that's what a lot of people who wants to do the masters, you know, aspire to. So yeah, after the two interview stages, some people of course fall off in the first one. There are three stages. Two of those stages are interview. The first one is the notification telling you that you are through to the second stage, where you get interviewed by a couple of people. Then the third stage, a lot of people. Then you wait again to finally see if you made it because they're interviewing people. I went through the second one. I can't remember a lot of the things I said, but yeah, I had my background as well was journalism. And I know that's not like traditionally a sports, you know, industry career. So I had to tie in my work with athletes, which was very, you know, true in that sense, because it wasn't just about interviewing athletes and asking them what they like or how they feel about the goals they've scored. It was about understanding, you know, for instance, how playing on certain days affects them, how, you know, their mental health works. You know, it was getting really close to the issues that affected them. So I was able to represent that in my interviews and say, I want to understand more, you know, about, you know, how athletes are being treated, as we all know, they're like the reason for sports itself. Like without these athletes, we can as well all just pack our bags and go home, right? So I was able to, you know, pitch that angle, pitch my interest in, you know, digital media, pitch my interest in storytelling and how, yeah, we need a lot of that here on the continent. So yeah, long story shortened, at the third stage, they will ask you questions about your financial standing. I remember asking for a full scholarship. I think I did ask for a full scholarship. And then they said, what if we can't give you, you know, the full scholarship? Would you take half and would you be able to come to the masters? I clearly did not have any money, but I was like, yep, I'm going to come. I'm going to find the money. I'm going to come. And they're like, okay, we will let you know. We will let you know if you've made it. And I think maybe like a couple of days after, I got an email saying congratulations, daddy, yada, yada. So that's the process for everyone, really. And what's also interesting about the masters, unlike others, is you can pay half of your fees and you know, when you get to the course, you pay the remaining half. No, you have to pay it all at once, which sent me into a spiral. So I had like a week or 2 weeks, I think, a little bit more than 2 weeks, I believe, to find half of, you know, 25,000 Swiss francs, which, you know, luckily I did. And one of the ways I did that, which is just dropping the tips, was I went to a club like Remo Stars. Kunle Shoname is the CEO of the club, and I'm so grateful that I was able to, he saw, you know, reason in my pitch to work for Remo Stars even while I was away in that period. And I don't think it was about the work I was going to do. I think he just saw that this was a valid thing for anyone to aspire to, and the fact that like I was the first Nigerian coming back in like 13 years to the program, you know, he was like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, give you, I think it was about 2 million naira, which was a lot of money, still is a lot of money, but in that process, I didn't go begging for the money. I went with proposals that I am going to, for instance, contribute to your social media channels through the period of my master's for that 1 year. You have a youth academy. How about I create a program, a media training program for the young players in your academy? So yeah, there was value exchange, of course. But it still takes a lot for, you know, an individual who technically hasn't even met me before, until Wale Adegun introduced me to him to say, yeah, there is value in this program you're off to do, and potential for it to go really well. So those were some of the ways I raised this money and paid my fees by the deadline. If you need an extension as well, the program very well understand that it's a lot of money, and some students used to ask for, you know, a couple more days extension, which you can get depending on the situation. And yeah, it's worth knowing as well that what else do they do around that period? Well, I think that's pretty much it. Some people also cannot, you know, even after accepting and not meeting the deadline, you know, they just have to drop out. drop out in the sense that they have to like resign the admission for certain people, which means that other people who didn't get it might get called up, you know, upgraded to an admission to the program. So that happens as well. In my class, we're like 32 people, which was like super competitive. I think that's the most populated class in a bit. But yeah, I think it's usually between 25, 26 to about 32 people, you know, per class. So like I said, it's quite competitive. So yeah, that's the part about the admission. If the other 101 points to note is that it's done in three different countries, and that was one of the appeal for me. Also because they teach you history, they teach you the humanities, and then they teach you management as well as law of sports. So that's like, you know, three different very important aspects of you know, a 360 approach to the sports industry. So the humanities and history part of that is taught in Leicester, which is De Montfort University in Leicester in the UK. The second part is at Estia Bocconi in Milan, Italy. Gorgeous, gorgeous school, by the way. And then the law part of the program is taught in Switzerland and Neuchâtel University. And yeah, like I said, when I saw the pictures I saw of Samson at the Masters was of, you know, him and other students at, you know, was it Arsenal or was it Chelsea or was it, you know, Manchester City? And yeah, that's the access you get when you are at this Masters. There's so many connections with brands I've been able to build over the years that you can get to go to a lot of these Premier League clubs in the UK and hear firsthand from, you know, their directors, from different managers, you know, giving you, you know, answering questions on how the club is run and the strategy that makes the club successful. And that goes across the other countries we visit as well. So yeah, it's not just about what you're being taught in the class. It's the hands-on experience that you get when you go into these, you know, these clubs or these field trips to see how sports is being run. I mean, I also am in Milan. We went to Ferrari, which was also great to see a Formula One experience and see how the business is run in that sense. So it doesn't 100% equate to, you know, meeting these people or getting a job in these places. But I don't imagine that you walk into these spaces, you see these things, you meet these people, and you, something in your mind doesn't shift. And I think that is one of the most, a lot of students will tell you that is something they enjoy the most from what the FIFA Master can give you in terms of access. You just get to go into, you know, this space. You get to go to UEFA, you get to go to FIFA. You get to go to the Cycling Federation, you get to go to the Fencing Federation, Equestrian Federation, and you just see how, you know, the entire ecosystem works. And it gives you, I think the most important thing is that it also gives you, a lot of students come into the program thinking about, yeah, I want to work in football. Oh yeah, FIFA is the best thing that can ever happen to football. And at the end, by the time you walk through the door at the end, you're thinking, wow, I think that I want to work in this other department. I think that there is an overlooked aspect of sport here that gives you an opportunity. I think that, you know, rather than working for a sports organization, I'm better off working for an agency where we're really orchestrating and, you know, determining the strategy for these sports organizations. So I think I've moved from 101 to 105 right now. But yeah, those are the basics, I think, when it comes to for the program. And then once you're inside the course, the things you can expect to see and how your mind changes. So yeah, I hope I added a bit of value with my long rant there.
You know, I'm short of words. I don't know what to say because I think this is a revelation. And when you get revelation, when you get insight like this, if it is quality enough, it stuns you into a short silence because you are in awe of the moving parts behind the scenes that make people's dreams come true. You are in awe of the little things here, there, and everywhere that come together, and then they form the big picture. But people only see the big picture, but they don't know what happened behind the scenes. And another thing that is keeping me in awe is, as you're saying these things, I'm going through your Instagram, and which is Debola Dibanjo, by the way, for those who are listening to us right now. And I'm piecing your story, your audio story, with the picture stories that I used to see then. And then it's making sense. I'm currently looking at your picture with Gianni Infantino now. And in my mind, I'm like, wow, what I would say or probably ask if I get the chance to take a picture or to stand in the same room with Infantino. I'm still going to get to that, but I'm just trying to, you know, let people understand that if you're passionate enough about the sport, what Debola said in the last 5, 10, 15 minutes thereabout should leave you wondering that there is more to this game or sports generally than just sitting in front of the TV and enjoying it. Yeah, that's good enough also, but if you want to go deeper, there's space. If you want to get more involved, there's space. I've always said this, I'm passionate about the marketing aspect of sports. You are passionate about you're passionate about the athlete rights and everything around the athletes as a person and all. Some people might be passionate about branding, others might be, you are listening to this and you're about sports media, you're about journalism. There is more and there's space. Debola's story is proof that if you want it badly enough, there's space. There are templates you can follow. If there's none, you can as well go on ahead and create for yourself. You know why? Because Debola mentioned something. Throughout her process of application, one thing was applying to the FIFA Masters program. One thing that I think that caught my attention was she pitched. She pitched. When she was applying, the guys who were interviewing her, or the ladies, as the case may be, she told them what she has done gives her, how she can apply what she has done, and she can connect it to what they're going to teach her, and she's going to use it to push further in what she has done in terms of, you know, seeking for the betterment of the for the athletes and all of that. When she needed the funds, she pitched. She sold what she had. Look, I have this. You need it. I need this. You have it. How about the value exchange? And it worked. So she didn't sit down and say, wow, where are we going to get money from? And then you just forgo it because you feel like, I said, that's the end of the world. Like our elders always say, one way doesn't enter into the market is a Yoruba adage, though. But I don't know if they have markets with just one entrance these days. In the old days, they still remember. I don't know. I don't know. Well, but kudos to them. You think of it.
How did they build a market with just one entrance? Isn't that like a something very hazardous anyway? Like that's a lot of risk. It's a dangerous thing to build.
Too dangerous. So
possible. And the elders were right when several roads into the market. Yeah, they saw something we didn't.
So exactly. And I think that the 101, the how she got in, it's just, if you can, I'm not saying this because it increases the listenership count of this podcast, but listen to it again. There's a process. There was a structure. It didn't look like it then, but there's a reason why she's on here to share, to let us understand that, yeah, these things are, you're looking at, it may look far. You're probably listening to this in Zimbabwe or Ghana. And you're saying, from how am I going to go from Zimbabwe to Milan? I mean, how am I going to go from where I am now?
Just to add real quick, Damola, something I did not mention, which is also very important, about my pitching to the scientific committee and, you know, like trying to explain how a simple journalist career actually fits into the sports industry. It's really worth knowing that a lot of people who apply to the masters, some people in some cases don't have traditional sports careers. In my class, for instance, there was a lawyer who actually finished top of the class, a lawyer who had experience in just regular law. I think it was civil law or something. She wasn't even a sports lawyer. So her name is Jen Savoie, I believe. She's a Canadian citizen, applied to the FIFA Master, had no experience in sports. She probably doesn't even know who certain football stars are. You might be able to mention all the football stars in the world. That's not her business. But of course, she's brilliant. She was able to pitch and sell herself. And yeah, she did the entire Masters, you know, comfortably and finished top of the class. Like most, and I'm not really someone who is big on results and stuff, but merit, she topped the merit list. So it's a case of just, you know, finding the connections, finding the dots, seeing how you can, you know, immerse yourself in whatever industry you want to immerse yourself in. My career as well took like, it keeps like evolving in that sense. So I started doing radio. I didn't even want to be a sports radio presenter, but that was the opportunity I had. So I got in, you know, through sports. I continued, you know, as an analyst. I had alternative music show podcasts. And then I worked for the BBC and became, you know, a producer, a presenter, and everything that was possible. And now, even though I'm still working in communications, I'm doing it more from a policy, corporate comms angle. Next decision I decide to make with my career, I could decide to go off and work in, you know, partnerships or marketing or, you know, anything that involves branding in, I don't know, think of a company that is not even related to sports. So there is always a room and a way for you to apply yourselves into this thing. And that's, I think, one of the very endearing thing about the Masters. The scientific committee are not looking just for people that have, you know, a big sports background or have worked with certain organizations. They just want you to have a good work experience, as, you know, any Masters would. They want you to be able to show that you can demonstrate ability to work in multicultural environments. They want your vision as well, to be clear. What do you want, you know, for your career? Why do you think sports can, how can you infuse sports into what the skill you already have? How can you, you know, merge your traditional career and sports together? What can you add to sports, and what can you as well do to develop sports where you're from? So yeah, it's I'm just, you know, piggying back on that thing you said about how there's a lot of pitching there that's involved. There's a lot of, you know, you just not selling yourself short, basically, or just, you know, you need to widen your imagination, widen your thinking, believe that whatever it is you're thinking in your head is actually possible, because there are paths, you know, for it. And it might not be the traditional path. It might mean that you have to create yourself, like you said, Damola. But yeah, there is always something for everyone, I think.
There's something for everyone. That's how wide this ocean net is. And speaking of wide, I have like, and I think I need to start getting used to it. Whenever I'm speaking to people, I have like, I'll say, okay, I have 5 questions. And then when she's answering question one, the 5 questions automatically give birth to 3 children each. And then automatically I have 12 questions. I'm like, how are we going to do this? But we're going to get through. Before I speak about your dissertation, let's talk about your classmate. You mentioned your classmate. You said you were 32 in your class. And I think you've touched on their backgrounds a bit. You mentioned some that did not even know anything about sports and they applied. Were there other people from Africa? Or was it all continents, or were you the only African in your class? Were there other people from Africa? Do you still keep in touch with those other Africans?
Yeah, we do. We keep. I think if you go to any international front, there is always a very big chance that you would see Africans, Latinas, people from you know, backgrounds that are not, you know, as dominant. Egyptians. Am I missing anybody here? No, I think that was all of us. But we had a Senegalese in the class, but he held a French nationality. So he's African, of course, but he was representing France for that one. And yeah, we keep in touch. Like, that's the great thing about the Masters as well. Like, you have a group of people who literally spend almost every working day together, because there's a lot we have to do in 11 months. Usually, like, I know some master's program take breaks. I know that some master's program are done in 2 years. We are trying to, like, do three different modules in 11 months and have exams and do field trips and have your dissertations and do, you know, online camps and a lot of things like that in that short period. So all we have at the end of the day is ourselves. Like, we are mostly always working in groups. We leave as well. We leave in the same places for most part of the countries we were at. So yeah, these people become your best friends. These people become your fighter if you need to pick one. These people become, you know, whomever it is you need them to be in the moments that you're with them. And then, because it's also like a close-knit relationship, you guys are looking for jobs, you know, together. Then, you know, when people get jobs, they become your point of contact in so many places. So it's inevitable that in a way they're in your lives for, you know, as long as you need them to. And yeah, it's not just the Africans that we keep in touch together. I think everybody tries as much as possible to keep in touch. Surely some are closer to one another than you know, usual. But yeah, it's, someone called the FIFA Master a cult. and I see why she said so. I see why she said so, because yeah, even from, not just from our class alone, like, once you go somewhere and you hear that you did the FIFA Master program, there is just that understanding of what it takes or what it took to go through that program. I mean, it's about the time spent, the money spent, the prestige to have been able to do that and succeed, you know, doing it. So yeah, it kind of leaves a lasting bond, I would say. So yeah, and all the Africans in the class are doing great as well. I know Yasmin from Egypt works at CAF now. I know Nadi as well works at IMG in London, and you know, they worked with, they recently just signed a right to they recently just signed AFCON rights, media rights as well, which was great. So I mean, I'm sure it's great for him to be able to work in an organization that is situated at his country. I know that another Egyptian, Nadia, as well, works with a club in Egypt. I'm a fifth bro. I'm trying to remember the Rwandan lady, Diane. I'm happy I did. Also, you know, works in some capacity with CAF. So yeah, everyone is doing great. And we recognize what it took to get ourselves to whatever level we're currently at.
Before we take a short break, I just quickly need to ask. I don't want to ask you the cultural question now. I'm sure well after the break I'll ask you that. But before we take the break, I need to ask you. I'm noticing a trend, so I just want to assure myself that when I go and get money and I pitch value and I get money, that I will get a job. Everybody mentioned in that program has a job. So, I just want to be sure.
Okay, let me put out a disclaimer, and I think this is also important because I get DMs sometimes, interestingly, from people who already are in a master's program in, say, like the UK or in Canada or anywhere, saying that is it worth taking the, you know, applying for the FIFA Masters again and doing that for another year, you know, basically owing to the kind of access that it might have. And I think it's 50-50, to be honest. Like, I wouldn't say yes and I wouldn't say no. Obviously, I'm a living testimony to how that works out. And a lot of my other colleagues are as well. But it still takes, it's, the masters will tell you that it's not us who gets you the job. We will give you the tools. It's you who will go out there to get what you need. So yeah, it's all about your own, you know, it's about your priorities, really. It's about how much you're willing to risk. It's about your conviction to knowing what exactly you want. I mean, I got a job before I finished the master's, same as some of my other colleagues, but it took some other people months before they got their jobs. There is also an element of, you know, your rights to work in Europe, especially as an African. So unlike, say, some master's program in the UK or in other parts of the world where you could get a student visa that allows you a couple more months to get a job or, you know, to work while in that period before you get a job, the FIFA Masters doesn't have that. It's a lot more complicated for in a country like Switzerland where, you know, the program is registered. As an African, you have double the risks because if you don't have a work permit, some sports organizations will, yeah, it's, they won't be able to take you because it takes them not just the money, but the time and the wait time as well to secure your rights to work in that European country as an African. So it could dwindle your chances of getting a job, pretty much. Maybe not dwindle it, but just extend it, depending on how things work out. So the risk for Africans, like I said, is double. And I remember towards the end of the masters, it became a little bit of, you know, a pressure for on all of us, especially the non-Europeans were like, we were panicking a little bit, like, what is going to happen? I wouldn't say I was panicking as much because in my case, there was only one thing I could do, and it was comms, you know, comms or digital. So I was going directly for, you know, roles that were like that. And when I also started getting interviews, you know, in places like UEFA and FIFA, I knew, okay, maybe somebody will take me at the end of the day. I also had like a job offer in Lagos with TikTok. So I had like a buffer of, okay, if Europe doesn't work out, and, you know, I have my old job at the BBC and I have, you know, a new offer as well in Lagos. So it's a risk. You need to be prepared for whatever happens. You need to be prepared to, I guess the mindset to have really is, I am going to do this because I can afford it. I'm going for the experience. I'm going for the adventure. I'm going to make, you know, connections that will benefit me for as long as I want to work in the sports industry. I'm going to get knowledge. And when all of that is done, yeah, I will find different ways to implement, you know, those knowledge that I've gained, even though it's not, you know, in a sports industry or in a sports organization immediately. So yeah, it always comes down to what your priorities are, you know, in that instant. But what, you know, the masters will tell you is, yeah, we cannot guarantee you a job. We have a good track record of people getting jobs, but we would say that it's owing to their personal abilities, their personal luck, if you want to put it that way, or the way they've positioned themselves. Clearly, the masters positions you, I have to admit. It definitely puts you, because, I mean, when you're applying for a role, like when I was applying for FIFPro, I can imagine that when the hiring manager at FIFPro saw my CV, they could see that I was, I think it also helped that he knew the FIFA Masters as a program, but they could see that I was currently doing the program that has got lots of access and is highly rated. In my application and I think my cover letter as well, I could demonstrate that I lived in Europe, which surely was an added advantage. I could demonstrate that even though I'm still doing the masters, I am now in spaces that helps me understand, what the industry needs and, where FIFPro stands in the industry. So yeah, it those kind of positioning does help because you're still in the vicinity, in the area for which you're applying to these things, at. I remember that when I had an interview with UEFA, like the final stage, I had to go into the office to do it. You will not be able to exactly do that if you weren't in the area, if that makes sense. So yeah, it does position you, but I guess why I would never say yes or no is I mean, even though before I say that, I think that it, like I said earlier, it depends on what's priority for certain people. And even though we might be focusing on what's like immediately, under our nose, we might be focusing on the fact that we want a certain outcome from what we've spent our time and money and, basically invested in. It's worth remembering that it actually has more benefits, I'd like to imagine, than just whatever job it is you'll be getting. Like, it has immense benefits that you might not even realize until years after. It has benefits that I personally have not even like tapped into yet. And I'm being told that as well. So it's about knowing what's important for you in that period. So saying yes, come do the masters, I mean, it's a no-brainer if you can afford it. If your end goal is wanting to work in the sports industry in Europe, just like any other masters as well, there is a possibility it can happen because like I said, gained the knowledge and put yourself in that position. But if the ultimate goal is to immediately get a job, if the goal is to, live in Europe, especially as an African, that is a 50-50 risk for sure. But yeah, I guess I'll just say that there is benefits in looking at the bigger picture first, and then saying calculating your risk before trying to do it.
Right. Anyway, regardless of how well positioned you are, in this life, it's all about risk. You take a risk, you're ensuring that you put in your all, and then let your all do the speaking for itself. You're still listening to
Yeah,
the.
and I'm just going to add, Amola, before we wrap this up. When I was coming to the masters, to be fair, I wasn't thinking about getting a job here. I was like, well, it would be nice to get this, but I guess that mindset already made things gave me like a different outlook on what things could possibly be. And the mindset did change as well, like 3 months before the masters ended, like when you start seeing people around you, applying for jobs, people, panicking about how their passports might be the hindrance in their way and things like that. Surely you start thinking, okay, maybe I've just, wasted all of my money and stuff like that. But that was never the dominant feeling for me personally, and I would recommend that is the mindset to have. I was like, yeah, if I have to go back home to Nigeria to continue my work at the BBC or any other opportunity that comes up, I will be going with immense, knowledge, and that immense knowledge will definitely stay. The master's is still going to stay on my CV, and I'm pretty sure there will be more opportunities coming from wherever, just because I have, gained that knowledge and I've positioned myself, in a particular way. So, yeah, I know the realities are very different for so many people, especially if you're from this part of the world. But it's first about just having, I think for this program, it's first about having an open mind and prioritizing the experience and the knowledge and the connections you will get before anything else. Because yeah, like I said earlier, if you look at the bigger picture, that is just so beneficial in many ways, you know, and it's something that would probably last a lifetime.
Beneficial, last a lifetime. I think what Debola is doing or has done at both the FIFA Masters program, definitely beneficial. What she's doing for us as regards what she has done at the FIFA Masters program right now on this podcast will definitely last for a very, very long time. You're still on to the 90 Minutes Plus podcast. I'm your host, Ruti Midarambola, and then I'm speaking to the well-traveled, ever-eloquent and super storyteller, Debola Adebanjo, who, by the way, is a big, big, big Burna Boy fan, by the way. I had to mention that. I promised myself I was going to sneak that in somewhere, and I have achieved my goal. So three quick questions before we wrap this up. So what we had in mind initially was that we're definitely going to make this a two-part series, and we have so much stuff already in this first part. So we're just going to make this first part the beep and the FIFA Masters program. And in the next episode, we're going to be talking all about proper hands-on what she's doing in her current role, how she's helping players, how she's being a pivotal part of a global union that represents football players worldwide. But before we get into all of that next episode, let's just take this home. And I have like three questions in my head before I'm sure you will always have time for Arsenal, especially even this Arsenal of this season. So we have to talk about the Gunners. But quick one, you mentioned three modules. You said history, history, humanities, and the law of sport. I want to quickly ask just a light-hearted question. Which of those courses did you find the most fun to learn? Which of them was the most hectic?
Law definitely kicked my butt. Like, and it's not just my butt. Like, everybody who wasn't a lawyer in the class, it was... Oh, Lord. The most drab, dreary, but interesting part. And I definitely the most intense part of the masters. And the thing is, law is super important. Like, trust me, there is sports it all about, you know, a lot of these laws, a lot of these regulations. And yeah, I could see why, you know, they left it for last. I could also see why it was the longest module. I could see why it was the most intense module. Like we had to do moot arbitrations, you know. We had to look at cases and judge cases. I liked, you know, writing the exams. I liked the lecturers. In the bit where they could keep my attention for 90 minutes, it was very enlightening, everything in law. But it was just very tough. It was just tough. And I cannot remember most of it, but I get the way it works. And I think that's kind of like very important as well, if you get what I mean, especially if you don't have a background. Knowing how things will work is just as important. My favorite one, it's hard to pick, to be fair, but I would go for this. So I might have confused you. There is the history and humanities. So it's called Humanities of Sports, but the reason I said history is what we learned in that first module was a lot of how sports, you know, became sports, you know, okay. The history of tennis, the history of rugby, the history of football. That was like the first module. Then the second one was management. So management also had a lot of soft components. So we learned about sports sustainability, the fundamentals of sports, sports HR, sports technology, sports finance, which is also very interesting. But I think my favorite has to be the history and humanities. It's the humanities for sure. Like there was just, maybe it's because it was traditionally taught in English, because that's the module that we took in Leicester, DMU University. Yeah, there was just something about the lecturers. There was something about, you know, the speakers. The fact that we also could visit, you know, a lot of the Premier League clubs and understand their business models and everything. I think it's definitely the humanities module that I like the best. Followed by management.
Right, of course. Definitely not law. Definitely not law.
Oh my God. Law. Hey, I respect lawyers, though, like, differently now. Like, I see lawyers differently. And even at Fifth, bro, like, the legal team, they're literally superheroes. That's the way I see them. It's just what they do is pretty intense, you know, understanding how the system works and just being able to translate a lot of this information. It's crazy.
Crazy. Speaking of crazy, let me quickly sneak this one in. Living where you currently live, what's that word? Migrating, exactly, from one place to another can be tough. Migrating from one place to another place to learn the culture, to learn the traditions, to immerse yourself in a differently, entirely different educational setup can be very, very strenuous. For you, were there any of these challenges, cultural learning challenges, for you as an international student in the program, and how did you cope with these challenges?
That's a very good question. I would say I adapted really well, to be fair, and maybe it's because, you know, I worked with the BBC. There we had a lot of international colleagues, so it helped. There is also that exposure a lot of us Nigerians have to Western culture, like prior. So in the music I listened to, in the books I read, in the shows I watched, there was this certain level of understanding and exposure to foreign culture. So that kind of like prepared me to some extent. However, it's still, I think the struggles are a bit internalized in the aspects of, you know, showing up as, you know, who I really am. And I think that probably is the biggest struggle, because there is just that unsaid thing where you cannot entirely be yourself to the extent of which, you know, you can be yourself or you would have been who you were, like, back home in where you're from. And I don't think, maybe that's just a me thing. I think everyone who has had to move to a different country will tell you as well that, you know, the fact that I'm leaving a little bit of myself behind when I show up every day is something that affects us in different ways. And at the start, you will manage it, you know, properly, because after all, you just have to show up and do your thing. But then I think in the long run, it starts becoming very visible, at least to yourself, that I'm not really myself. I'm not speaking the way I want to speak. I'm not acting the way I want to act. I'm being, you know, a little bit too conscious or sensitive about, you know, this thing and that thing. And I think even though it wasn't so evident, you know, during my master's program, as I was, you know, in the midst of my colleagues, in the midst of people with similar backgrounds like mine, in the sense that we all moved, some of us for the first time, to do something new. It has later started showing, you know, years down the line, say, you know, where I work and those kind of things. So yeah, it's interesting that it's a process, you know, and that's why, you know, organizations are, you know, very keen on making the culture of their workplace very friendly to people of diverse backgrounds. It's why people are encouraged to be themselves, even though I still feel like capitalism will never let us be ourselves truly, as some things are just a certain way. But yeah, it wasn't the most difficult, but there are ways where there's some things I still felt like I wasn't doing right. I hope that answered your question.
Most certainly, most certainly. I think that at the end of the day, one of the major fears, funding aside, another fear that people can have is moving from what they are used to the unknown, moving from the usual to the unexpected, and they are not sure what they can get, and especially for a program like this where you have invested a lot financially. And you're going to be investing a lot to cover so much in such little time. You spoke about three modules in 11 months. 11 months. Yeah. I think that's a lot. That's weighty. And taking all of that in with the environment you are new to, you're traveling at other times to either Leicester or to Milan, and taking all of this in can be a lot for people. Some it can break, some it makes. I think it depends on your person. Mm.
That is a very good reflection, Namola. That's a very good reflection because, I mean, there is, to start with, the weather change, you know, which if you're coming from a tropical region like ours, will maybe just knock you off first. Like, the cold will not make any sense to you at so many points in time. There was that. There is also, as someone who, and this is something I've been, you know, floating to people, and I've been getting some responses that matches the way I see things, and it concerns how you dress. If you're someone who perhaps pay attention to what you wear, or maybe your outfits, you know, determine your mood, or just helps you, you know, feel confident and fits into your creative process, like me, you know, having to change my wardrobe and having to you know, acclimatized to the new environment with what I wear as well, like, messed with me. I didn't even know it was messing with me. It was later I realized, okay, there was a problem there. So there is that for certain people. There is also the, you know, the question of food, which is definitely more expensive when you're living abroad if you have to, you know, eat to satisfy your African palates. There is, you know, sometimes just not, I guess, understanding people. I also feel it's easy for us to understand us, and I mean Africans, to understand, you know, the Europeans and the way they see, you know, life, or the way they see their ideas and everything. But on the reverse, it's actually more difficult for them to understand us, I would admit. So there were cases where I needed to make myself, you know, clear in certain ways that kind of, like, you know, means I'm extending myself. Meanwhile, if I were back home, like, everybody gets it, you know. Maybe they get it with the way I roll my eyes, or the word I say, or how I laugh, or what I'm just saying. Like, people get it. But, you know, abroad, you need to, you know, further extend yourself to make sure that people see that you get what is going on, you understand what is going on, and you're capable. So there is that too. So it's a very, very big change. And I know a lot of people talk about, you know, migrating a lot. It takes a toll. And it's interesting because you think maybe in the first year you're doing okay. Second year, well, you see, I'm managing the cold better now. Everything is fine. And then the third year, a new revelation of how the adapting process is messing with you, like, pops up. And then you realize, okay, so this is why I'm feeling this way. So that's why I said at the top of the podcast, I'm not sure we got it in, that it's like every day you're wondering, you know, what is going to be new for me this day? What is the new thing I'm going to realize in this new place that I'm in? And how will I, you know, start adjusting to that or adapting to it as well? Like, I've been traveling for about, I guess, almost 2 years now at Schiphol Airport. And I just realized only yesterday that there's a place I need to tap my transport card before I take the train at the airport. And I was like, what? You mean that has been there all along and I didn't know that's what I'm supposed to do? And here I was thinking I knew it all, you know? So yeah, it's a very interesting process. And it's just about, I guess, learning and building your emotional capacity to understand that we are very different. Like, the cultural differences is always so glaring. Like, and as it doesn't matter how, you know, great the culture of the place you work in, people are just going to be so, so different. And I think it's one of the most important learnings for me, because I just feel more confident, and there is literally nowhere you're going to throw me that I won't thrive because I'm dealing with, you know, someone who is Argentine and someone who is Japanese and someone who is Korean and someone who is from Italy and an Irishman and an Englishman and a Dutch person. And trust me, we are all so different, you know. So it's a blessing for sure. It's a curse on its own, the differences, but yeah, it's a blessing depending on how you see it and how you work around it.
Speaking of depending on how you see it or how you have been hearing it so far, it might have been a very, very long conversation for others, but depending on the angle at which you are looking at things from, I think you would agree with me that this has been a worthwhile listen. It has been expository, it has been explanatory, and it has also been helpful. Where do I find these words from? I don't know, but they keep coming and I'm happy about it. Oh yeah, glad.
Yeah, I'm glad it's been a good one. I really hope it's useful for a lot of people. I know that I tend to drone on and on, but yeah, I guess that's the the disadvantage of having to put I'm having to explain 3 years worth of experience into, you know, one speech band or some 90 minutes. Trust me, it's probably going to take just as long to talk about these experiences, like 3 years to really explain everything that has gone down in the last 3 years too. So yeah, I guess that's one of the disadvantages of trying to make as much sense in a very short time. But then again, I don't have an excuse, right? I'm supposed to be the master storyteller.
Perfect. I did not see that end coming, but there you have it. I was in my head, I was like, well, the storyteller should definitely be able to know how to weave our way around words, long or short. Yeah. Perfect excuse.
I was looking in and called myself a master storyteller. I've never actually said that before, but maybe I should put that on my Twitter bio.
It fits you perfectly.
Because yeah, I'm really, really good at that. I really am.
So you must have gotten it earlier. Like I said, depending on where you're looking at this from, this has been a quality first half. Yeah, yeah, I'm wondering, first half. Yeah, that's right. First half, because we're going to be having a second part of this episode and we're going to be transitioning from her time at the FIFA Masters program. And we're going to be talking about how she transitioned into a FIFA Pro, and we're going to go in depth. If we open that book now, that's another hour and we don't want to lump it into one sum. So we're just going to take a breather and then we're going to record a second part for you guys to enjoy. So in the meantime, we're going to have a commercial break from FIFA Masters, BBC, FIFA Pro, whatever. And we're going to go, I'm not going to ask about Burna Boy. This is a sports episode, for crying out loud. Let's talk about Arsenal. Yeah, doing well. For those who don't know, I think Arsenal has to rank it maybe like Devola's third baby or fourth baby, very dear to our hearts, very close to our hearts. I don't know if the love is still burning like it used to be.
It's burning with a lot of sense now. You know, like I had this reckless, childlike, innocent love for Arsenal. Now I'm a bit more controlled. Like I love them, but not to the extent that I would let it hurt me. And I think that's just what happens when, you know, you've been hurt or you've had your heart broken like a couple of times. You just wise up. And if you don't wise up, well, I admire you. But yeah, I do it with my brain now, not my heart. But nonetheless, it's just so good to be enjoying, I think that's the word, to be enjoying the football, to be enjoying the camaraderie and everything the club is experiencing now. Like it's just so good. Personally, I don't know what you want to hear, Damola, but I'm not. It would be nice if we win the title. It'd be really, really nice.
Everybody's talking about the title. No, everybody's talking about the title. I wasn't actually going to talk about the title because I feel like that's a microscopic way to look at what is happening at the Arsenal rap, because I think what is happening now is like a bedrock for what will happen later.
That's a good point.
You look at how they played against Porto, the second leg, and you're looking at young boys who don't know when to throw in the towel. They don't know when it's not going to come. They know what they want, they know they can get it because they've been getting it in times past. And that is how champions are basically built. You look at the way Manchester City play. They play you like as if we know we are going to score. We don't know when, but we know that the goal is going to come. That's the way Arsenal plays now. And that's the making of a champion right now. So whether the title comes now or it's definitely going to come later. So looking at it, will they win the title, elephant on the tree, yada, yada, yada. I think for me, is the perspective as a neutral, I'm not an Arsenal fan. I just look at it from the point of Arteta is up to something. The fans will know about it later. That is, if you have not picked up on it now to see what is happening. But aside that, for you as a national fan, I wanted to get your perspective on the manager, even the team itself. Is it the kind? A lot of people have said a lot of things about his facial expressions. Harry has so many of them, both on the touchline and in the pressers. But for you as a fan, a breath of fresh air, something different, something unusual. How would you describe Mikel Arteta as an Arsenal manager?
Well, I wish I had the most elaborate response for you, but I don't. But I just think he's really cool. I think that, I don't have so much insight to what he's like because I've not been following too closely. But clearly, if he has brought a new way of thinking and a new energy and a new mindset to the club and to the players particularly, then clearly he's brilliant. And he has also done it in, I don't want to say record time, but if you look at the squad he inherited and the number of, say, transfer windows he's had to actually bring in the players that he wants, he's done such an amazing work in a very short time. I mean, I know Arsenal have been spending some, fair amount of money, some decent amount of money in maybe not as much as Manchester City, but they're up there, I think, in the top three. Nonetheless, he's really made the team like world beaters. I don't think that it's a fluke that in two seasons they are competing for the title. Like that's insane. And I think it's just there is something that also struck me in the way he approaches things, which I think is maybe the most, admirable character. He doesn't treat football like it's just football. Like clearly, we talk about how young players need, basically Gen Z generally, the working culture is changing for them. Like the way they see life, the way they see work, the way they approach, the work they do is different from the way, boomers used to do in the past. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is more focus on, mental health. There is more focus on the kind of environment they're asked to work in. And that's something you can see is putting into his everyday coaching and lifestyle, from, digging up old tweets to asking them to play, mental games, as we've seen in some of these documentaries. He's really tapping into the human connection and taking it, away from the traditional way that sports would usually do things. Talk about the way he shields the players as well, rather than throwing anyone under the bus. So I think when you get the human connection onto your side and you're able to tap into their human emotions and, work with what they need exactly, that is the recipe for success. So it's more like the players really understand what they're doing. Like they understand that they're not just doing it for him or for the club, they're doing it for themselves, because they've been made to realize that the agency that they have as an individual is very valid, if that makes sense. So that is one thing I think he's done very well. It's not a toxic environment. And once you don't have that, there's a lot to then build a good foundation on. So it looks like a formula that is really working for him, and I see it, yielding very good results. And look at the players having long-term contracts. I haven't particularly looked closely, but what I see is a very big return on profits for Arsenal in the coming years. Like, it is, they have lots of young players doing great. I think the average age is maybe 26 now, if I'm not mistaken. The likes of Saliba, all of these players who are now like committed to long-term contract, and they still have a lot to give. So by the time they start making, you know, profit off sales, and of course haven't gotten full value on the contracts they have, then we see that they're in a more, in a stronger position to then start competing for top players in the market. And it only looks like it's all, you know, up. It's going up from there. So yeah, it's just amazing. The club is in a healthy place. And I think that's the most important word anyone can describe Arsenal at the moment. It's just a healthy environment right now. When it comes to the culture is healthy. Finances, more importantly, looking great. The relationship with the fans and the team and the club, healthy. And yeah, it's a model for how lots of clubs will want to run their businesses nowadays, I think.
And this is a perfect spot. I think this is the perfect. We've had the first 45, and I think VAR will be able to add an additional, I don't know, X minute. And we've had so much fun in this first half of the conversation. A quick Google search of the name Debola Adebanjo, and one major theme will pop up. I just did that now, so I'm not just saying it off the top of my head. You'll see fifth pro in at least three of the top five results you will get, and that's what we'll be talking to Debola about in the second part of this. I don't want to call it series, it's just part one, part two, there's no part three. So of this episode, of this chat, I'll talk to her about her role as a campaign and internal communications manager at FIFPro. By the way, there's one post on LinkedIn, and she says, I'm on Twitter and TikTok, but I'd rather you follow FIFPro on TikTok, as I've recently managed our launch there. Yeah, I'll check that out. I'll definitely be checking that out so that I can learn, and then we can have quality conversation in our next chat. By the way, if you missed it, episode 97, it used to be the first X Minutes podcast, now it's the 90 Minutes podcast. Check it out. I spoke to Debola in 2020, and we spoke about the BIP. Today we're speaking about the BIP, spoken about FIFA Masters program, and we have spoken about the Gunners. In the next episode, we will be talking about Debola as one of the team members at FIFPro. You can follow our socials, Debola. Just go to Google, Debola Adebanjo. You'll find her on socials. Pretty active on Twitter and Instagram. Yep. You have to keep up on Instagram. That's all I can say.
Well, my Instagram story is where the action is. Is where a day in my life really is. But yeah, I want to have time to do talks, to be honest. It just will take me having a full-time job. I don't know how these girlies do, you know, combining their 9-to-5s and you know, having a creative. It's a lot of work. It's a lot.
Speaking of a lot, you can complement what you've heard here with the images. I especially loved the behind the scenes at FIFA the Best. We do not have time to take that. FIFA the Best. The pictures she took at Ferrari, those old cars. Ooh, wow. Gives you dreamy eyes and makes you wonder what is possible, especially when you can travel the world doing the things that you love. We can't thank you enough, Debola, for this first part. Revelatory, insightful, yes, expository. Mm-hmm. And definitely it opened our eyes to see what is possible, not just in football, but in the world of sports at large. We'll definitely be doing this again. I'm not sure when, but we'll agree on the time. We'll have the second part, and we'll have it published. Thank you so much for your time, Debola.
Thank you for having me.
All right, this will wrap it up. First part, please send us to follow the podcast wherever you can. Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, yes, and leave a review when you can. Whatever you're doing in the days ahead, I hope it's profitable. I hope you stay safe, and most importantly, I hope you make the most use of your time, because life is incredibly long, but life is also incredibly short. We'll catch you in the second part of this chat. Until then, cheers. Bye for now.